Welcome to Shelfware Single Setting. I'm Scott.
And I'm Mark.
Hello, hello. And today we're going to talk about Stanley G. Weinbaum, the specific story, A Martian Odyssey.
Martian Odyssey.
Yeah. Great, great
one
story.
One of the most wondrous stories of early science fiction and really unique in its kind for a long, long, long time after it was published in 1934, I guess.
Right, 1934, yeah.
Must have been 1934.
Right.
It's 1 year before his untimely death.
Right, in Wonder Stories.
All magazines in Wonder Stories, how come?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Do we know?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. In the introduction, I have a book, The Best of Stanley G. Weinbaum. Isaac Asimov wrote an introduction to it. And in the introduction, he said that, you know, Wonder Stories was really the third of the three major magazines. And yet this story exploded on the scene and people tried to mimic it. It was, like we were talking earlier, he called it a nova, right? A second nova.
The second nova. The first one was Doc Smith,
mm-hmm.
if I remember correctly.
Yep, that's
and the
right.
third one was Heinlein.
Right.
And Asimov made an interesting point that the impact that Weinbaum made was unique in that kind, that he was considered to be at once one of the most important authors of his time with his first story.
Mm.
And this is not what happened to Heinlein, for example. Heinlein got better with the time. Weinbaum started with a flash bang.
Right, right. Yeah, and he also said that Doc Smith sort of stayed what he was the whole time. He didn't grow.
Yeah.
And Heinlein's first story was not considered one of his best. It was Lifeline.
Yeah.
And then Weinbaum, of course, he had a very short career, which is tragic. You know, he passed away of cancer very shortly. Well, a year and a half or so after this story was published. So
I think he died in the end of 35.
Wow. Yeah.
More or less.
Right.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask yourself, what would have gotten out of him if he had more time to expand his parameters? He was writing, we'll not talk about it today, but he wrote a sequel to A Martian Odyssey. And there might have been more to come in that universe. He wrote a few Venus stories that are quite readable. He had, as far as I remember, he had published a romance novel before Martian Odyssey and had tried to sell another science fiction stuff to someone else, which to no avail. And this was his first sold story, and whoop, here we come.
Yeah.
Incredible start.
And it is. It's an incredible story. I read a couple of reviews before we got together, and you know, some of them say, "Oh, it's really dated and all this thing," but I didn't feel that way. It is a product of its time, and in that, it's super interesting because he was working, he was trying to be rigid with science, he was working with Mars as they knew it in 1934, and just for that alone, the story is wonderful. To see what they thought at the time, what Mars was, you know, what they got right as far as we're concerned now and what may have been incorrect is interesting. But the most interesting thing is what he found on Mars.
Yeah.
That's really what he brought to the table that was new.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. If it's dated in one aspect, one might say that his narration technique was maybe not the narration technique. His technique of dialogue was a little problematic. We come to that later, perhaps.
Okay.
What he did, I'm trying to find the English word for that. Our listeners may have found out now that I'm no native speaker, that he's taken the method of, I think it's called messenger report. And this is a rather dangerous stunt, I think, to make an action-lasting story as a messenger report.
Yeah, I see.
Because we all know it's already over. The things that have happened are over. You know that our protagonist is safe and sound, and even more so in his world building. And this I found rather intriguing. And it shows that he was a stylist in some aspects that was really excellent. The world building is also so made that we know the story has happened in a past. Even the situation where these guys get together.
Mm.
I try to read from that part, if you like.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
This, of course, was in the old days, less than 20 years after the mad American Doheny perfected the atomic blast at the cost of his life, and only a decade after the equally mad Cardosa rode it onto the moon. They were true pioneers, these four of the Ares. Except for a half dozen moon expeditions and the ill-fated Delancey flight aimed at the seductive orb of Venus, they were the first men to feel other gravity than Earth's, and certainly the first successful crew to leave the Earth-Moon system.
Mm.
With a few sentences,
yes,
you get a whole universe delivered on a silver tablet with watercress around. And I think that's incredibly, incredibly sublime for that time.
Yeah, yeah.
You can find this technique, by the way, in Tolkien.
Hmm.
Who with two or three hints shows that there was an old age where this and that happened. And it's what Isaac called repertoire elements.
Hmm.
You know, he puts in some stuff and you can see the world behind expand if you make your own mind about that. And this is really elegantly done.
Yeah,
and
that's
it's
great.
Much more important for me than his sometimes etwas wooden dialogue. The captain, for example, is some kind of moron who gets rather short-thrifted but doesn't seem to learn.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
He's always running against the same wall.
Uh-huh.
Maybe a few words to the content.
Uh-huh.
Shall we?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the Ares crew, as mentioned, has landed on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And story starts when the chemist, Dick Jarvis, is saved by the crew. Most obviously, he's gotten in some kind of trouble that will be later revealed to us.
Mm-hmm.
And he's telling, in the sense of a messenger report, what happened to him after the machine he had used got broke down, and he had to decide whether to stay at the broken machine or to walk back to the spaceship,
mm-hmm.
in the hope that somebody finds him right in time. He has enough water for the watch. It's a little bit like the Martian from Andy Weir, but
mm-hmm.
a friendlier
mm-hmm.
surrounding. He can breathe. It's a little cold, but he can
make
his way.
Mm-hmm.
And on his way there, he meets several Martian creatures. We talk about, among others, a person we call Twill.
Yeah, Twill,
and Twill
right.
turns out
Twill.
To be...
Twill.
Phil
yeah.
turns out to be a friend for him,
mm-hmm.
who he saves Twill's life first, and then Twill saves his life.
Mm-hmm.
And all along the way, he finds what a strange planet Mars is. And furthermore, to the anger of his captain, he finds out that human intelligence might not be the most important thing in the world, not even on the next planet.
Yes.
Which
yes.
is also, for 1934, mm-hmm. quite some stunt. Because if you mm-hmm. look at, say, Flash Gordon or stuff like that, which is running parallel to that,
mm-hmm.
there's always the human measure the most important thing.
Right, right. And it's interesting, you know, so what you're describing there was new, right? So
absolutely.
So he's writing, he was before Campbell,
yeah,
right, and he was before Heinlein, and I would call this a story that both Campbell and Heinlein would have loved.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
So yeah, he could definitely have influenced Heinlein, but that you talk about the dialogue and things, you know, but this matter of factness, you know, just the way that they speak to each other, it's kind of manly, right? You know, there's this, you know, we're all heroes here.
What is dated maybe is a sense of humor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This
I
is
agree.
Something. He makes the captain. He turns the captain into an idiot and what you call it, a soundboard, or
mm-hmm.
you could call him a straight man in a comedy number.
Yeah, yeah.
And this gets a little long in the tooth in the story. That's
right.
maybe the own point where we think, oh yeah,
mm-hmm.
this could have been done more elegantly.
Right.
But
right.
Campbell, yeah, mm-hmm. I seem to recall. I have written it down. I hope it's a correct quotation. Campbell, write me a creature who thinks as well as a man, or better than a man, but not like a man.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I remember...
And that was asked, you know, he was asking for a story like that long past this date. So Weinbaum was not responding to that request, but that request is a famous request by John W. Campbell of his writers. You know, I would love to see a story like that. But here it is, you know, in 1934.
What holds up and what I thought at the time was something that seemed to me rather modern, or say, I read it in 1980, which seemed to be of my time, was a skeptical or a humble way to looking at humankind.
Mm. Sure.
We have a lot of places where he
Well, this idea, I mean, that's happened throughout, you know, human history, right? The, you know, we're the center of the universe in, you know, the, like the Fertile Crescent or something. And then now we're the center of the universe in, on the planet, you know, and now the planet is not the center. And now, maybe intelligence itself isn't the center. Ted Chiang wrote a wonderful story about that recently, by the way.
Oh, I see.
I don't know if you've read that, but yeah. So the alien in this story, you know, often aliens are used in science fiction to stand in for some human quality that they're trying to show. Star Trek did that all the time, if you call that science fiction, right? But this is really hard science fiction. His aliens are existing independent of humans. You know, they've got their own qualities.
And their own agendas.
Their own agendas, right. And they're not, in his story, he's not trying to make a point about humanity other than possibly what you're saying is, hey, we're not the only ones. There are others, right?
I'd even go farther. What I really liked about the story when I read it for our podcast here, something I had not remembered so well, was the complete indifference to mankind.
Yes. Right.
Normally, we make our entrance with our usual glare and flare and whatever.
Yeah.
And whoop, here we come.
Right. And
watch out.
Yeah. And in so much science fiction, you know, that's what it is. You know, they land and, you know, humans are here. Humans are here. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody rejoice, right? But you're right. It's like, you know, they didn't even know we were there. You know?
Except for the
Lovecraft does that, and it's horrifying, you know, having this cosmic indifference. But yeah, for us to run over to Mars and they don't even know we're there. Good stuff. And I loved that Tweel was fantastic.
Just fantastic.
And his attempts to communicate. I absolutely adored the scene where he, drew the solar system, the human drew the solar system, and then the, Tweel, the alien, filled in some of the moons. You know, it's like, I know there's two moons on Mars and there's one on Earth. You know, when he was trying to describe, I'm from Earth, you know, the human was. Yeah. Love that scene.
And there's more of that on 20 pages or so.
Yeah,
the idea to describe other aliens to explain other aliens to our human protagonist, to Dick, by using mathematics.
Yeah.
1, 1, 2. But not 2, 2, 4.
Right, right.
For example, to describe someone who is a little off our scale.
Right, right. Yeah, and he was struggling to understand, is Tweel telling us that what he's describing is beyond us, and or is he saying that they're lower, you know, intellectually, you know? They don't understand 2 + 2 = 4, but they understand 1 + 1 = 2. So they're somewhat intelligent, you know.
Yeah.
These conversations that they were having were amazing. And then you have the human that's on board the Ares that keeps, you know, he's in total disbelief. He seems to be completely skeptical that there would be an intelligent.
The captain.
Yeah.
Not the two other guys. We have, and that's something I really like as well. Mm-hmm. We have a multinational crew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have a German engineer,
which
is rather, rather uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
Name me 5 science fiction stories where the German is not either a refugee or a Nazi.
Wow, yeah. That's
And we have Frenchman.
Mm-hmm.
Just to spoil something, in the second story, the sequel, we find out that the German lives under a dictatorship.
Really?
Mm. Yeah, with 1 or 2 sentences. And we find also out that the French live in a kind of republic, etc. And that does not stop Weinbaum from thinking that there could be a common working together.
Yeah, wow.
Which is also something not very much of its time.
Yeah, wow, 1934 for sure. Yeah, and then Star Trek took that, you know, much later in the 60s, you know, putting everybody on the ship there, you know, multinational.
Except for Germans.
Yeah, there was no Germans, you're right.
You always find out that the series is in trouble when the guy with the swastika come aboard.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
Third Reich always sells.
I hadn't thought of that before, but yeah. Now that I sit here and I think about that, I'm.
That's what I liked about that there is a multinational crew. just like Star Trek, including a German, not just like Star Trek, being a little bit, punished with a heavy accent, and being an engineer.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Two cliches already.
Yeah.
And check the box. Wonderful. And it's absolutely, it's of no importance, and that's what I like. It is of absolutely no importance. There's no point in it. It's just there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that, as a German reader, I really, really miss, being there without making a point concerned with the Third Reich.
Right. Yeah.
And that was, I thought, oh, well, that's how it goes.
Yeah.
Just do it. But the easiness with which Weinbaum makes his points here is absolutely stunning. And even if you can say some of his structure of his dialogue is pedestrian at best, there is a certain intellectual elegance here that is really, really rare, even to today's standards, I guess.
Yeah, I feel the same way. You know, you read this story and it does stand above other things. And it's because of, you know, what he's doing. Yeah, what he writes.
Okay, let's take a look at the guys he meets there. First one are the so-called biopods, moving grass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It has no role after all. It's also of no importance. You just get the sense of wonder.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. The grass is running away from you.
Uh-huh.
And we don't know anything about the motive. We don't know what it is. It's grass and it's running away. And it gives you a strange feeling. It gives you a feeling that you have left mentally your planet reading it. And it's just there.
Yeah, a foreign place, right. A place, an unknown place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then he does something wonderful. He saves Tweel, Dick Jarvis, from something with black tentacles.
Yeah.
This will play a role later on, but not right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's also elegantly made. He saves Tweel out of the claws or tentacles of this creature. They become friends. And then they start to take a walk together through the deserts of Mars.
Yeah.
And we all know Tweel could run away, sort of fly or jump away, but no, he stays as at any time. He stays as a leader, as a companion to Tick. We do not know about the motives. He just does.
Yes.
And also this purity of action, there's no philosophical overboarding, no hard thinking about it. It just is. Mm-hmm. And you have to wrap your own mind around the story. What is going on? Why does he do it? It's marvelous.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yep.
Okay, after
that, he finds those the pyramids, right?
The pyramid beast.
Silicon-based life forms.
Yeah,
that was
Silicon
cool.
Valley on Mars. Yeah, that was really cool.
Yeah.
Tell us about them.
Yeah, well, they were, there was a bunch of pyramids. There was some that could jump, you know, they would jump and they would land in the ground and become like solid, like concrete. You could knock on them. Right. And then
they get larger and larger.
Right. Exactly. And it was something else. And you know, the creature would, they're all this, you know, while they were observing this stuff, you know, Tweel and Jarvis, they were interacting, you know, and Tweel was trying to show Jarvis things about these creatures and show him how hard they were. You know, they were solid, they were rock, you know, they were, and so they were learning to communicate at the same time, which, you know, so it's like, you know, Weinbaum's doing a couple things at the same time. He's showing us this scientific, more alien creatures that he's come up with, and then at the same time he's furthering what Jarvis and Tweel's relationship is, you know? And again, we don't know what Tweel's motivations are. And I love that point that it just is, and we don't know why he's doing what he's doing, but he's doing it. And that's cool.
Yep. And that's another thing I really like is the not knowing is complementary to the, what I called humbleness of being human, to step into a world where you have no way to comprehend what's happening at the moment. You know, he was a scientific author. He was by profession Weinbaum, a chemical engineer. Mm-hmm. And our protagonist is the chemist, or the chemical engineer of the spaceship, which I do not think is no accident. I think he more or less identifies with him and with his point of view.
Yeah.
And you can see that he sees in another Sense of Wonder trick, he sees how old the stone creature must be. He's taking some calculation and says, if it's always the same creature putting out the bricks, building the pyramid, climbing out, building the next pyramid that is a little bit larger, and then next the pyramid is a little bit larger again, this creature must have been 500,000 years old. And when you read that with 12 or 13 years, or even with 50 years, you say, wow. That gives you just a perspective how unimportant and how short-lived we are. We got the subject of short life again here, comparatively to the world around you, to another human being. I do think, I'm not absolutely sure, if he had lung cancer, he will not have been very healthy at that time.
Yeah, so he knew at the time he wrote this story, is what you're saying.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. I'm not sure about his biography. There is a sense of finality in the story.
Mm.
Of individual finality.
Yes.
Not of a societal finality.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of that story and the sequel is, we need to make friends. We have to become friends with Tweel and his people. We will be on Mars. We will have to get along with each other. Right. In the next story he gives, for example, he hands Tweel over the atomic drive of the spaceship.
Yes.
No? And this is also rather uncommon. Normally, technique is something to be exploited. We find a higher civilization, hip hip hooray, we got the technique from the aliens. This goes vice versa. We give our technique to them. They had their big day thousands of years ago. We are technically more advanced in that aspect. We give them the drive in the next story.
Right.
But still, you find here a sense of finality, a sense of how big the universe is, how incomprehensible it is, and how old it is. And this is something at that time, that condensed story, which I found overwhelmingly professional and wonderfully told.
Hmm. Excellent.
And you have this strangeness again with, and that was a common joke between a friend of mine. We always said, wir sind Freunde, ouch. We are friends, ouch.
We are friends, ouch.
Okay, let's go to that creature.
Oh, yes.
They come into a sort of cave system.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, we have to. I have left something out. So what happens next is that our friend Dick Jarvis is convinced that he sees a beautiful, beautiful girl,
mm-hmm.
for which he has a soft spot on Mars, trying to lure him into her arms.
Mm-hmm.
And although he knows that this cannot be, he's completely convinced to see her and running into, we have gathered by now, a trap. The dream beast.
Right, right.
And here Weinbaum does something which is rather complicated. He uses the same syntactical structure for Tweel to tell something else. You 112, he 112. That does not mean both on the same level, but if you think of something, mm-hmm. he will give you something.
Mm-hmm.
And the dream beast is luring Dick Travis by his own desires into the trap.
Yep.
But probably as his desires are not Tweel's desires,
mm-hmm.
Tweel only sees black tentacles, just we have the reverse situation from the beginning.
Exactly.
And can get Dick mm-hmm. out of the trouble.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, that was awesome. Just the whole, you know, communication thing again, you know, from when he was drawing those planets on the ground to 1 + 1 = 2, 2 + 2 = 4, and then what Tweel was, you know, what Weinbaum had Tweel convey with just those pieces of information.
Yeah.
And then to have Jarvis understand what he's saying and tease out the meaning from what he's saying. It felt very real to me. It worked for me very well, and I thought it was just extremely well done.
Yeah, he's got five pieces of chalk, and he's painting the Mona Lisa.
Yeah, right, right.
Incredible.
Yeah,
and
it does show a rare intelligence in the writing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then again, both of our protagonists come out of the trouble alive, and they come into the cave system with our friends, the barrel people, as we might call them.
Right, the barrel
guys. Who do
guys.
Some absolutely incomprehensible things. And I was reminded of, do you remember the Fraggles?
Yeah, I do. Fraggle Rock.
Fraggle Rock, them ones, yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought of the Doozers.
Yeah, the Doozers, right. Yeah.
For those who have not read the story, mm-hmm. They are carrying stuff around in wheelbarrows, I guess is the word, right?
Yeah, this cart. And,
looking like barrels. And if you talk to them, they answer with the same words. Dick has the absolutely idiotic idea, moronic idea, say, we are friends. To which the creature answers, we are friends. Mm-hmm. We are friends.
Right.
And that's some total of the communication. Except when Dick stands into the way of one of these creatures, it pinches his nose.
Yes.
And he says, ouch, as a reaction. And from then on, every creature greets, we are friends. Ouch.
Yep.
Which I think is hilarious.
Yeah.
And in this cave system, they run around like in a labyrinth.
Mm-hmm.
And our protagonist, Dick, finds a crystal. And this crystal is maybe the point where they get in trouble. But first of all, the crystal heals his wounds.
Yes.
The pinch in the nose is getting better.
Mm-hmm.
And the wart on his finger that he had ever is going away.
Mm-hmm.
This crystal obviously destroys sick meat, not sick mm-hmm. flesh. What's it called? Gewebe.
Yeah. Right.
What would you call it?
Flesh. Yeah.
Flesh. More biological.
What's cells. It called? Cells.
Yeah, cells.
Uh-huh.
It kills. It kills obviously sick cells
mm-hmm.
and leaves the
healthy ones,
cells
yeah.
alone. The healthy ones alone.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, everybody who knows about cancer cannot stop his hairs from standing up now.
Mm. Yeah.
Because that's a cure what everybody's waiting for.
Right.
We have another modern aspect. We have a multinational crew, but it most obviously is in some aspect commercial. Because if I remember quickly in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
the captain says, oh, damn, we've lost the films you made. These films would have... bring in the costs we had for this expedition, which is something that normally a federal astronaut does not have to think about.
Yeah, right, right. So you're saying it's not a government-sent thing? Or
We're not absolutely sure about it.
Okay.
It's of course, it's privately funded.
Uh-huh.
Or they think mm-hmm. that with the photographs, they'll be able to refund it.
Right, right.
That's the word.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a way of thinking that has more to do with private entrepreneurship than with,
that's fascinating. Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that aspect, but you're right. That is an interesting thing in the 30s as well.
Yeah, and the idea mm-hmm. to say, okay, if we got this stone, that may be the cure for cancer.
Mm-hmm.
We might have some other interesting thing to give to our people.
Right, right.
And wait a minute.
Yeah, and again, that's that finality you were talking about. It again reminds us of how finite our lives are, and here's something that will help that extend.
Okay, so when Putz comes to save him, the German engineer with the second dinghy ship comes to save him. Tweel flies away. Gets away or jumps away. It's a sort of flying because of the Martian gravity.
Yeah.
Sort of like Superman.
And that's after they have, Jarvis and Tweel have both, Tweel's staying, doesn't have to stay, but he's staying and they're fighting, right? They're shooting.
That's his last stand.
Yeah, right. Huh? And they're like, okay, it was looking pretty dire. And then, but yet Tweel stayed and, was shooting a weapon as well. And then in comes the Ares, right? Or the boat.
The dinghy,
And then, then Tweel, rather than get on the dinghy with Jarvis, is like, in your head, it's like, okay, well, Tweel knows Jarvis is fine, so he's going to go back to his life. But he leaves, right? He's not escaping. He just left.
Yeah. And still the end,
Mm-hmm.
The four men of the Ares were silent, even the sardonic Harrison. At last, little Leroy broke the stillness. I should like to see, he murmured. Yes, said Harrison, and the wart cure. Too bad you missed that. It might be the cancer cure they've been hunting for a century and a half. Oh, that, muttered Jarvis gloomily. That's what started the fight. He drew a glistening object from his pocket. Here it is.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And boy, I guess how much he wished he would have found it.
Yeah, no kidding.
Someone would have found it for him.
Yeah.
He was 33 years old, I guess, when he died. Imagine that.
Yeah, that's tough. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. No, and you know, the things that you're pointing out here make me believe that he did know what was going on, the author.
I think so.
Yeah. Wow.
I think so.
Yeah, and it does give that a whole new feel to it.
I know that lung cancer can kill you really fast. One of my profs who I studied was diagnosed with lung cancer and died 3 months or 4 months later.
Wow.
But normally it takes a little longer to kill you off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So what we could have had from Stanley Weinbaum, who knows? Yeah.
But on the other hand, what did we have from him and how thankful we might be
very thankful
that the story can still be readable. I was doing... I had a special class, which would be complicated to explain why they were special, but we had to read a novel or other short stories, and we were not too much controlled by the government or by the schooling board or whatever. And I said, okay, read a bunch of science fiction stories.
Mm-hmm.
And this story still works.
Yes.
Even to persons who do not read very much, even to students who are more... trained by psychological advance or psychologically, how shall I put it, overblown or complicated stories, they can make head or tails of that story and say, ah, wow, yeah, that's strange.
Right.
Oh, that happens. And what does it mean to be human? That's a question you can ask without using too much psychology. I'm not against psychology, don't get me wrong. But into a 20 or 25 pages story, if you put too much of, as you know, Bob, into it.
Right.
It can kill a story off.
Yeah. It makes it uninteresting.
I'm not against didactic stories, not at all. And I'm really, really good if I learn something. But this one here is like, it's like a comic in that aspect that with a few scribbles, you have a whole picture.
Mm.
And that's art.
Yeah, I agreed. Yeah.
Out of that story, people would nowadays make 450 pages novels.
Very, very
with
true.
With less impact.
Yeah, with less impact, right.
A trilogy, probably.
Yeah.
That's not against then Kim Stanley Robinson's Miles trilogy is fine. That's something else. That's not what I mean.
Yeah, you
but
bet.
But you know what I mean.
I do. Well, wonderful. So The Valley of Dreams is a sequel.
Yeah.
Yep, okay.
It's it's a little clumsier. Mm-hmm. It's not that original. It has a nice twist and a nice idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was promising more than that story could deliver. But maybe two or three stories into a series, it would have worked.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You haven't read it, I guess.
No, I haven't. No, nope,
well, I will not tell you about it.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I thought so. There's one aspect in which Weinbaum's story is also dated, and that is his attitude to what he calls primitive languages, or what his protagonist calls primitive languages. And being a trained linguist myself, I don't think that his argument is really sound here.
Okay.
I know what he means.
Mm-hmm.
I have to look the pages up. This is number 9. Wait a minute. Okay. It set me wondering if perhaps his language wasn't like the primitive speech of some Earth people, you know, Captain, like the Negritos, for instance, who haven't any generic words, no word for food or water or man, words for good food and bad food, or rainwater and seawater, or strong men and weak men, but no names for general classes. They're too primitive to understand that rainwater and seawater are just different aspects of the same thing. I do not think that this is very sound.
Mm. Okay.
If you are able to see those things in their function and accurately describe them, where's the primitivity in that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good point. Mm-hmm.
But this may be office time and in its time, and I'm not the one who said, okay, we have to tear down all the monuments. There's another aspect that in the long chronicle of this podcast, two episodes in, that in the last podcast, Harlan Ellison, who put on the alternative world of Jeff T., in which all the old stuff is reproduced and all the old stuff is written on and on. He mentions a story by Weinbaum that, of course, never really happened, but which in Jeff T's world, even in the 70s or 80s, was to be heard and seen. And I thought this was a fantastic move from Harlan to use Stanley G. Weinbaum and put him in a place sort of for saying it could have been better and it could have been very, very different.
Yeah.
And it's sad that it didn't happen. And life is what it is, but there's always a price tag attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
Life goes on and the people fall left or right side on the road, falling apart from us, and we move on until we fall right or left side of the road, there is a price attached to it. And even if in the end we might come all together again, there is an inherent sadness that you can find in the works of Tolkien, but he needs much more words for it.
Yes. So very true. He needs many more words, but
That he does.
Yeah. That's great. Okay, well, that was fantastic. A great selection of a story. Thank you. And our next story is one of your selections, right?
That's right. It's Jack Vance.
Jack Vance, right. The Last Castle.
Last Castle.
Very much looking forward to that.
I'm really looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm.
Was a wonderful first read when I found it when I was 12 or 13 years old. It was a sense of wonder, as I've mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And what wonder it will be, we'll find out in our next talk, I guess.
Wonderful. Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you for the talk.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yes.
And then we'll meet again next time, same place. Bye.
Bye-bye.